what Brooklyn sounds like.
Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit, and I'm Dr. Lisa. How are you doing today? I give a shit. I'm a little disappointed that, you know, well, I mean, our government is really, like, hard to stomach. I don't need to say any more than that. You've heard enough from people who are much more qualified. But thanks for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn today. Do you know that we do all this for nothing? For nothing, just for you, for free. So now is a really important time to support the media. You know that, right? I'm looking at you. Yeah. Get up and earn some money. Just don't sit there. Get a job so you can donate. So, like, go to RadioFreeBrooklyn.org and donate. So I have this lovely intimidatingly brilliant man and talented. Okay, it's okay. This is my counter transference, which I'm so nervous. I have to get this out of the way right away. It's Lauren Monk. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Dr. Lisa. I have a question for you.
Already?
Yeah. What is my copay?
We already told you we're not making anything out of this.
Is this going to be covered by Obamacare? I just want to make sure that my session is taken care of.
I don't think this is going to be valuable enough medically to actually pay for it, to tell you the truth. But it will, you know, listen, guys, this may not cure you, but we will all learn something and be entertained. I guarantee you that. So Lauren Monk is a really complex person for me to describe to you. He basically is two people. He's Lauren Monk. Lauren Monk is this artist who makes paintings that are really complex. He's so complex. It's complex with it. I'm going to try, and then I'll let him tell you. So he makes paintings that are, they're funny. You know, they're funny, right? I mean,
yes,
they're funny.
Yes.
They're funny. So
the world is funny.
They're funny, and they chronicle the art world in sort of maps, in sort of a map. What do you call that? Cartography way?
Well, it's cartography, and there are other pieces that are more diagrammatic, dealing with the flows of art movements and things like mm-hmm. that. But first of all, I would like to say thank you, Dr. Lisa, and Radio Free Brooklyn for having me in here. It's an honor to be here.
No, the honor's mine. I also told Lauren that part of my contract, My countertransference is my fear that we're going to have self-effacing competitions, because he's really self-effacing, I'm really self-effacing, and it could happen. So be prepared.
Okay.
I'm ready. Are you? You're ready for this, Lauren?
I will put on my self-effaced, yes.
Do you want to still do this? Are you ready to go? You're up for this?
Let's rumble, baby.
Okay. So Lauren his paintings, which are sort of easily described as charts, just for you have to go to my Facebook page or his laurenmonk.com and look for yourself.
www.laurenmonk.com.
Do your own research, okay? But anyway, so his paintings cover the artists and the galleries in a fairly direct, almost literal way. But then he also does charts and graphs in a certain way, in his way, that are also conceptual about art history and art movements. Does that make sense?
And the philosophy of art and different kinds of ideas about what is art. Nobody really knows. We think we know, but we don't know.
And they're huge, beautiful paintings, and he's had many solo shows, and he's also had, I have a quote from Roberta Smith here, who is the premier art critic from the New York Times, about him.
Yes, we love Roberta.
We do. We love Roberta. I have it here. I'm not going to bother. I don't know. I'm not looking for it right now. I'm trying to talk to Lauren. I'm trying to get my shit together and handle this. So anyway, but he's been reviewed. There's so much press about him that most of the time that he spent here beforehand was trying to figure out what we could talk about that hasn't been actually discussed before. But then there's also James Calm, which is a personality that Lauren said is a documentarian gadfly. And he goes and visits galleries and he makes videos about the art, the artists, and street musicians. And that is really an important chronology or important reference. Somebody important said that it should, that he should get a MacArthur grant for it. Who said that? Was that
Kathy Bradford?
That's a big fucking deal, folks, if you don't know anything. That's a big fucking deal.
My mother? No.
It's true. And so you would, the thing about the videos that are so amazing is that you don't really, you can learn about art, but without, in the most like fun way. So that's James, how do you get, what's the website for that?
Well, you can go to YouTube and just type in James Calm Report, JamesKalm Report. I have two channels. And then there's also the James Calm Rough Cuts channel. So you can type in either one of those. I've got something like 1,300 programs, and I've been doing this now for 14 years.
And he has over, he has way over 2 million views.
Well, I've got, I'll tell you a little story about what's happening with the cleaning out of the social media. I actually had somewhere in the neighborhood of about 10 or 11 million views. And then after the last election, the people at Google and some of the other internet overlords were looking and saying, gee, we're afraid that somebody's been in here diddling around with the numbers. Somehow the numbers on your, the view numbers are used as a metrics of what's more important. So they just sort of erased about 35 or 40% of everybody's view count. So, you know, and I always kind of...
That's so upsetting.
No, but I thought to myself, you know, geez, if I was a Russian hacker and my main job was trying to figure out how we could distort the election and overthrow American society, you know, the first thing I'd be doing is I'd be going to the James Calm Report and be clicking on there constantly so I would drive up his view rates. So I just accept that you know, they had to chop off a few million views.
It disappoints me that the government is trying to control us and now Google does shit like that. That's fucked up, man. Here's the thing. I'm going to tell Lauren, I'm going to address my viewers and my listeners. I feel like I can see you, folks. I'm magic. I'm going to, like, Lauren is complex. So I'm going to tell you really quickly what, I'm going to give you some bullet points about him, and then I'm going to tell you what we're going to try and uncover today. Okay? So, things you should know about Lauren. Lauren Monk was born in Salt Lake City, Utah. He's a Mormon. He's not practicing now. He enlisted in the Army, and he had a career that was... let's say a stellar career, a lucrative, where he was supporting his wife and two kids for years until the late 80s. And then he, I would say, I don't want to, started a new and very important to all the art world people career with his deep dive into covering the art world. So what I want to know is, from Lauren is, I want to know why he's so obsessed with art, art history, artists, that whole thing. Like what's driving his, it's an obsession. And I also want to find out about, Lauren was saying that his being married and having kids has been a really, we were trying to figure out like how he went from his original career of making, what kind of paintings were you making? Neo?
Well, I was actually one of the two or three or four people that were kind of writing on part of neo-expressionism, but it actually was known as kitsch art. And there were a few other people that kind of got some kind of recognition for doing that.
And so you were having shows like, all over. You had a deal.
I was working with a lady named Gabrielle Briers. She was a paramour of Leo Castelli.
Mm-hmm.
I was getting some shows in Europe, in Paris. Elizabeth Krief was showing the work. I had a couple of dealers that were showing the work in Germany. I had some people in South America.
So, and you were supporting your family with the painting?
The family didn't really come along until 1987 was my first, the birth of my first son. And then 1990 was the second son. And, well, that was, that became a full-time job.
Here's the thing, folks. We've got a lot to cover here. We've got a lot to cover here. So I just wanted to give you a rundown of where we're going with this, okay? We're on it. Okay. So, Lauren, you grew up in Salt Lake City.
That's correct.
Did you, was there any artistic leanings in your family, or did you discover that on your own, or?
No, I basically discovered it on my own. there were not a lot of artistic things, although I have to say that what initially happened was when I was about 7 years old, my mom went in for a PTA meeting, and I think one of the teachers looked at her and said, I think your kid has got some kind of talent as an artist. And my mom was like, oh, gee. So I, for my seventh birthday, she brought home a paint-by-number set. And it's been downhill ever since.
See, I told you he was that self-effacing. So, he makes such great, big, huge, masterful paintings, and this is what he says, folks.
Well, but I, you know, so now I look back on it, and I've actually been painting for 60 years now at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, okay. And you're also one of three boys. So that was, right?
That's the, yes.
The middle child.
That's right.
So that must have been a guy-heavy kind of household, right?
Well, I guess so. You know, my mom and my father divorced when I was very young. So it was basically, we were raised by a single mom.
Mm-hmm.
A wonderful person. She was a nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically it was just the brothers raising each other.
And was your father part of that, or did he move away?
Not really. He lived in another city about 40 miles north of us. So, you know, we'd see him occasionally, but I feel like I never really had a chance to get to know him as much as I would have liked to. I mean, he was a person that was out there, but I wish I would have known him better.
That must have been really unusual in those days, because I know we're peers, we're in some ways, you know, we're not in our 20s. And so then I know in my day that was very unusual to have divorced families, right?
Well, I guess so.
Well, did you know anybody else, or was it, did it feel unusual?
No, I didn't really pay attention to it that much. It was just, we were running around, having fun, playing baseball, running through the fields, barefoot, you know, in a certain way, I was thinking it was kind of like Tom Sawyer or something, you know?
Oh, very so you just had, beautiful. So your mom fucking did an amazing job is really what it's sounding like.
Yes, she did.
She
did.
Really did, right?
Absolutely.
Because I'm here in happy childhood.
Well, yeah, no.
Okay. Oh, yeah, yeah. And I guess, you know, your brothers, you guys are all, it must have been fun. It sounds like you guys got along well.
It was a lot of fun, and I'm still close to my brothers, and they're both living out west, and I go out and see them when I can.
Nice. So, you enlisted in the Army. You said that was
That's correct. Big
turning point in your life, in your art career. We're talking about your art career, I guess. So,
yeah.
What happened there?
We're talking about the early 70s. So Vietnam is going crazy, and everybody's protesting, and it's terrible. And my older brother was drafted and was considering leaving and going to Canada. And he eventually turned it around and decided that he would join the Army, because if you joined, you could pick your military occupation. And mm-hmm. he decided to train to be a radiologist. And they ended up sending him to Germany. My younger brother was also drafted. He ended up going in the Marine Corps, and he was in Japan for 2 years. Mm-hmm. We were actually very lucky because no one went to Vietnam.
Did you have a lot of friends that went to Vietnam, or friends that were drafted?
Yeah, no, I did. And
that must have been really hard.
Well, you know, it's like looking back now, you had a couple of friends and people that you went to high school with, and they never came back. you know, and time goes by, and
wow,
you wonder what would have happened if that whole thing didn't happen or they had somehow gone somewhere else.
Wow. 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 So Germany sounds like I was getting the feeling that Germany was a good thing in a lot of ways. So.
Well, it was, and as I was saying, in a lot of ways, that's where I got my initial art education. I was able to go on leaves to Paris so I could visit the Louvre. I could go to Munich, go to the Alte Pinakothek. I visited Berlin. Mm-hmm. Although you had to have a special, because you're in the military, you had to have a special pass to get in there because that was the Berlin Wall was still up.
Wow.
And I remember one time I went on a Berlin orientation tour where you actually go in a train, and because it was a special military train, they bring you, it's like midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, they bring you up there and they close all the curtains and everything, and you have to travel, and you're going like 15 miles an hour or 20 miles an hour for, I guess it was 90 miles inside East Germany, and you know, you'd sort of sneak over and peek out the window shades and look around, and it was very dark, and then you come into the east or into the Berlin station, and it was such a kind of an example of what the shining workers' paradise was all about, because it was pretty strange. But then West Berlin was like its own little island. And
strange. Did it seem like desolate and sad, or like
West Berlin was boogie town, and there were a lot of really great art things going on. Mm-hmm. Part of it was because the West German government was spending a lot of money to pump up the cultural institutions there, so they were really going out of the way. Huh? If you were a student, or if you were going to be drafted or something, they would sort of say, you don't have to do that if you go and live in West Berlin, because they're trying to get as many people into West Berlin as they could. So there were a lot of, you know, youngsters, rock and rollers, punk rockers, all these people going to West Berlin.
Were you really like what was it like having access to all that art? Was that something that you hadn't had in Salt Lake City, or did that light
exactly
a fire?
Right. No,
what was that like?
It did light a fire, because you were talking about my obsession with art and the art community and all that stuff. This was the first opportunity that I had to see a real art community, a real group of young artists and people that were talking about it, arguing about it, having major exhibitions. It was fantastic.
And you were like, I want some of that.
Yes.
Did you went to the University of Maryland in Germany, but did you study art there?
No, basically, this was just a little, I was studying German language mostly.
I mean, did you think you were going to be like a professional artist, or what were you thinking?
I didn't even know what being a professional artist was. I had no idea.
But
there were no professional artists in Idaho.
So you didn't know any.
No.
What did you think you were going to do? Did you have a plan?
Well, not really.
What were you good at?
I was good at art. I was good at drawing. I was good at painting. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was in high school, they thought I was going to be an auto mechanic. So I actually had a 3-hour course, which was like a professional training course. So that was also the period when, you know, the Beach Boys were singing about Little Deuce Coupes, and everybody had their hot rod dreams, and where they were building chopper motorcycles and things like that. So that was always kind of a one thing that they kind of planned for me. And I guess I disappointed a lot of people when I didn't become an auto mechanic.
So you were thinking, so I could see that. So that's what you probably were thinking your goal was. I'll make a living as an auto mechanic. You'd be good at it, I think. I think you would have been really good at it. You're good at like making things, and you would appreciate the cars. Like a really high-end auto mechanic. Those people make a lot of, don't write that off yet.
I'm not, but if you wanted to look at, say, the California Finnish fetish people, those people, a lot of them came out of the hot rod ideal and all that stuff.
Those would be your people for sure.
Yeah.
So anyway, and then we moved to New York, the art students. So you moved to New York right after Germany?
Well, I actually went back to Idaho for a couple of years and was studying art at Idaho State University. And then I...
How did we get from Salt Lake City, Utah, to Idaho?
Well, my mom remarried, and She married a gentleman that had 6 children already, so altogether we had 9 kids in the family. That didn't last very long, about 2 years.
That's how you got to Idaho.
Yeah, that marriage fell apart, but we stayed. We lived in Pocatello. Mm-hmm. I went to Idaho State University, started studying art there.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was went in the Army, came back to Pocatello, which is where my mom was.
Mm-hmm.
Lived there for a couple more years. Then my dad, who was living in Ogden, Utah, passed away. Mm-hmm. I inherited a little bit of money.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I decided I had to get the hell out of Idaho, or I knew I would probably die there.
Do you think you would? But you wouldn't have done that if you hadn't been to Germany, I bet.
That's true. When I got out of the Army, I did come through New York and spend about a week and a half hanging out mm-hmm. in Manhattan and visiting the museums and some of the mm-hmm. galleries mm-hmm. on 57th Street.
So there you are in New York. Did you feel at home? Were you like, yeah?
No. This was a total cultural shock.
What was it like?
You know, when I was living in Pocatello and I would tell people I'm going to New York, people look at me and just go, why would you want to leave and go to Gomorrah? You know,
in
this
the
is
70s.
Like, this is like, you know, the worst, this is like the worst, most sinful city in the world. Why would you go there? And I said, because of art.
Huh.
So, but, it was good. I was lucky. I got a very cheap apartment about 2 blocks away from the Art Students League.
Mm-hmm.
That was a whole adventure unto itself. I was there for a couple of years. That's where I met Kate, my mm-hmm. wonderful
wife. Did you
wife.
Date? I mean, what was it like with chicks when you first got to New York?
Yes, I did date.
You did? It wasn't like you were like some like guy from like Podunk nowhere and
well, I was, but
girls like that. But you like girls and you're
yes,
charming.
Yes, I love girls. I think women well, they're the center of the world.
I bet women really responded to you because you're such a, what's the word I want to say? You know, you're a creative guy, but you have a slight veneer of wholesomeness.
Well, I always like the term wholesome. And
I think artsy
that.
Girls like that, you know, like
well,
he's a nice
you.
Guy. He's like a little bit of, he's a creative guy, you know, maybe a little artsy, but he's still like solid, right?
Yes,
would
and
that
I have
be you?
I have good family values.
Good family values.
Yes.
So you met. How did you meet your wife?
Well, we had a class together. We studied with a guy named Knox Martin, who I still love, and I think this guy is still running around making paintings. He's like 85 or something. But we met in his class, and we started dating and spending
time
together.
So she was an artist.
She was an artist, and. We ended up moving to a loft in Brooklyn
mm-hmm.
back
wow.
in the early 80s.
Wow. Was it desolate? What part?
Yes. Well, we were in the northern tip of Red Hook, and it was desolate. It was dangerous. Maybe we were actually in a group of lofts, and so we were not the first pioneers, but we were maybe the second wave.
So was it really awesome with like all these like radical art people all living in these lofts? Is it like that? Was it romantic?
It was.
Like that?
It was incredibly romantic. We would have these little Thanksgiving, because Thanksgiving's coming up. We'd have Thanksgiving parties, but we didn't have gas, so they were cooking these turkeys on wood-burning stoves and all kinds of things
wow.
like that. And,
real deal.
Yeah, and cars were burning on the streets. You know, people would go out and steal cars. They would take out the airbags, whatever parts they wanted, and then they would burn the car on the corner. And
God, look at all that fun
like
we
that.
Missed, you folks.
Yeah.
We missed those days. So how did so you were both like two artists making art in a cold water flat, cold water loft?
Yes.
Like a cliche almost.
Yes, it was. We wish we would have had a cliche. The cliche would have kept us warm. We could have wrapped it around us, but we didn't even have a cliche at the time. And my wife was working for Forbes, and I was working
what
at
What was she doing?
Well, she was actually working for the curator there. She was the assistant curator at the,
oh,
Forbes,
wow.
the Forbes
collection. Wow.
Yes. And I was working at the Utrecht, the art supply store, about right. 2 blocks away. So we'd go in the subway in the morning.
On 4th Avenue.
111 4th Avenue.
So we must have hung, we must have seen each other because I
probably.
Lived and I lived on, you know, it's starting to come back to me a little bit. I lived at 112 East 11th Street, like right at the corner of
okay.
11th and 4th. And I was always in the art store. I actually had a big crush on one of the art guys.
Do you remember his name?
I can picture him. He invited me to his family's picnic and then that was then try to get sex. And then I realized, then I realized, I let him know I like him and he thought he could get sex. And then I would avoid going in the store after that incident.
When you stopped being a painter? Or
No, he didn't put me off of that, but, or whatever. He didn't change the direction. Enough.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. If you would have told
me,
I would have
screamed. But he was really cute. He was so hot.
Oh,
he had
a lot
orangey,
of hot,
reddish, curly hair.
All right, there are a lot of interesting, attractive young people.
There were. So you worked there, yeah. So anyway, back to your wife. I can't. So, okay, so you two are living in a cold water flat. And so how did kids, like, what the fuck were you thinking? Why did you have children? You had it made. How could you bring children into that environment?
Well, you were talking about my early career and... one of the things was that we actually thought that there was a certain amount of money that was coming in. So we thought that there was, you know, some kind of at least a foundation that we could build on. Also, we both wanted to have kids. I probably was a little more convincing. My wife was thinking maybe she would go to grad school or other things. But
were the driving force there?
Well, you know, it was a partnership. It was a partnership.
Well, you know, that's really refreshing to hear that, because in those days, you always think the stereotype is the chicks behind all that. And I'm glad to hear that. It's good to hear.
If you don't have the woman, you're just passing your time. No, we were very lucky. She's a, you know, wonderful, maybe one of the greatest blessings of my life. Between her and the kids, I would be nothing. No, it's absolutely true. And, you're talking about that it was so risky or this or that, and at the time it I mean, of course we took, you know, chances, but it didn't seem like it was that strange. And looking back on it, it was a wonderful, beautiful, golden era.
So when you had a family, it was sort of like it just felt it wasn't like a big. It was like, okay, we're gonna just do this and make it work.
Well, you know, you were asking me about why I was obsessed with history and things like that. And even in my short life, say, just looking at the New York art.
How old were you when you had your first 30s, 20s?
I was in my mid-30s.
Okay.
And just seeing how things had gone. So I came into town just as Soho was starting to peak, and then the East Village was starting to take off. I was very lucky because Utrecht was in the East Village, so I'd take off on my lunch hour and sort of walk down East 10th Street and visit all of the early galleries and things like that. That's when my career started to take off. We started to sell some paintings. And but the tragic side to that is also that was about the time that the AIDS epidemic started to manifest itself. And as the decade went on, we started to have friends that started to get sick. And, you know, again, looking back on this from history, you kind of wanted to protect yourself. And so, you know, you have a career, you have an art world, but you're starting to see. And also there was the financial crisis, you know, the stock market crashed in 87. By 88, 89, a lot of the galleries had closed. A lot of people that had been superstars waiting tables and driving cabs and things like that.
Hi, Julian Schnabel.
And also the AIDS epidemic was taking off. So in a certain way, going and living in Brooklyn and cocooning was not such a bad thing. About the same time, we had actually made some connections with some people in Europe that were dealing me, and I would have a show occasionally, but they were doing a lot of dealing privately. So that's kind of what kept us afloat. But I didn't feel that it was bad. We were kind of just out in Brooklyn, raising babies, fixing up the loft, and that was all good.
But you weren't conflicted about, like, I mean, it doesn't sound like you were conflicted really at all, but you were able to fit that all in your lifestyle.
Well, part of it was that I just kind of dropped out of the New York art scene for about 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Because of your kids?
Well, partially it was because of the kids. Partially it was because, you know, our little community was being decimated.
Part of it
was because the stock market crashed and a lot of the high-flying money that people have been throwing at anything mm-hmm. went away.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just kind of withdrew and lived in our loft, and we would go to shows occasionally, but it wasn't, you know, if you're going to be a professional artist, you have to spend probably about half of your time just out schmoozing and visiting people, going to shows, mm-hmm. going to parties, hanging out with people, mm-hmm. patting people on the back, going to bars,
mm-hmm.
smiling, doing those kinds of things. And if you don't do those things, your career goes away. And in New York, it goes away real fast. If you're not in everybody's faces, people's memories mm-hmm. are about 5 seconds.
So how did you feel about that, Esther?
I tell you what, you look in the faces of those little kids and you look in the face of your lovely wife and you just say,
you just didn't
what could I possibly miss? I've got the world is right here.
So you were so happy at home, you didn't even think about it?
Well, those things are always, you know, they're always hanging over you because you have to think about money and paying the rent and whether or not this, what you thought was a career, is ever going to turn into anything more than a pipe dream.
But did you have FOMO? That's what I want to know.
FOMO?
I would have had FOMO. Do you know what FOMO? Oh my God. Lauren, I thought you were with it. I know we're old people, but I thought you were with it. FOMO, fear of missing out. It's a hashtag.
No, I never.
Oh, wow. Aren't you glad you came on the show?
Yeah.
So anyway,
I'm going to start FOMOing right away.
FOMOing here. So I'm like projecting onto you, but I'm like, you have this great art career. And then, I mean, I'm not family oriented at all, but so that's why I'm projecting my own thing. But so I'd be like, oh my God, what happened? People were buying my work. They know my names, all this. Look, it's all going on without me. Help. Wait. Did you feel any of that?
Well, I guess I did to a certain extent, but on the other hand, I also had a kind of a cynical view, maybe even a bitter view of a lot of what was going on. And having lived through the East Village scene and seen a lot of, well, I guess what I would say, posers, phonies, people who had never studied art, didn't know anything about art, but they sort of popped up in the East Village and said, oh, gee, look at all the attention these people are getting. I'm going to be a painter. And so the next day they walk into the mud club or something and go, hey, I'm a painter. And somebody go, oh, gee, I'll give you a show. And they, you know, and the next thing you know, they're on the cover of Art Forum and they've been painting for 2 days. And you're sort of thinking to yourself, well, gee, why did I spend 20 years studying art and anatomy and sitting in museums and studying, you know, Rembrandt and Van Gogh and looking at Jackson Pollock and reading all this stuff. And somebody who happens to have the right friends can just decide to be an artist.
So let me ask you a question. Out of all the people, since you know the history and what's come out of the history from that so well, so the people who have, stuck out over time, are those mostly, do you see any of those, you know, phonies or whatever you call them? Posers. Have posers actually been able to infiltrate the art history of the East Village? You don't need to name names.
I would say yes.
A lot or just a few? Not,
well, you know, it's a strange situation because in certain ways I appreciate them more now. And, you know, so there are people that I thought, they were just popped up and decided I'm going to be an artist. And they started playing the game and things started happening. They started to ride the wave. And looking back on it from 30 some odd years, I have to kind of congratulate them because they have the chutzpah. And in certain ways, I think that being a successful artist, you kind of have to have a certain amount of chutzpah, just of like going and saying, yeah, I am an artist. And and you can like it or don't like it or think I'm phony or not phony. And then it's a question of the work. Although in many ways, and this goes also back to what, you know, my ideas about the diagramming in the communities, the work in a lot of ways is the least important part of it. The relationships probably are the most important part.
Interesting, folks. Interesting. So, you know what? I have to remind people that they're listening to Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit right now, Lauren.
On Radio Free Brooklyn.
Thank you for helping me out. Isn't this the greatest radio station in the world?
You know,
you
people don't realize it, but Dr. Lisa has taken a lot of extra time and stuff. She's actually made a recreation of Sigmund Freud's office in Vienna in 1922. And, you know, I'm laying here. I'm reclining on this beautiful tufted leather couch, and she's even got all of the little African fetishes that Sigmund had, and she's fingering one now. And what kind of a cigar is that you're chomping on?
It's working for you. It's working for you. It's working for us.
We got to work with these people's mind. We're painting pictures for these people.
I know you are, and I want to remind people, though, I got to tell them. By the way, you're listening to Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit, which is on every Thursday, 2 to 3. You can go to the archives on Podomatic and look at all the old episodes and all that shit. But mostly, what you should really do is go and watch the James Calm Report, because then you will realize how much fun, how interesting art can really be, and have it, like, have it digested and handed to you like a candy bar.
Well, I wouldn't go
not a candy bar, but maybe a really good meal. Maybe not a candy bar, but it's like you do all the work for everybody, Lauren.
No,
admit
but
it's true.
I like to look at it like going to an opening and hanging out with your friend that's had a beer or two, you know, and watching.
Yeah, that is really good. That is really good. You get an inside view because Lauren is an insider, and then you get to be an insider. People know Lauren. They want Lauren to cover their show. It's an honor. And so you can, instead of just being some jerk off the street, stumbling into a gallery, let Lauren show you around, basically, without having to leave your home.
Also, I look at a lot of this stuff as a painter. So if you're interested in painting or what painting does or what it says or what it's about, I'm the
true
guy to be with. Yeah.
Lauren's like the biggest nerd. That's what another that was another countertransference, because Lauren is so knowledgeable about painting and paint and painters and artists and all this shit. Like if we were actually talking about art or art history, you would be, I don't know if you'd be disappointed, but I would be exposed for my ignorance, for sure. But you know what the most important thing right now is, folks? I want you to come see Pop Rocks Fest, put on by one of our great hosts, Evan Bieber.
Where is it?
And it's at Pine Box, and it's on Monday, November 12th.
Just around the corner.
It's free, too, at 9:30 to midnight. Just free. And it's going to be live performances by Peter Wise and the Cordius? I don't know. Anyway, you know what? Our shows are great, and all the hosts from Radio Free Brooklyn come, and it's free, and Pine Box is awesome. So come by Monday, November 12th. And so, Lauren, what was that transition? I wanted to get to the transition between, you with all the phonies, then you had the kids, and you loved having the kids.
Yes.
You loved, what was that like?
Still love it.
What was that like, being at home with the family?
Well, I have to say I was still spending a lot of time working in the studio, trying to get stuff made that we would then ship to Europe. My wife was spending much more time with the kids, but, they start to grow up, and then they start playing soccer, and then you become soccer parents. Mm-hmm. And then you're driving up and down the East Coast, going to soccer tournaments and things like that. And in a lot of ways, I don't regret the fact that I kind of took 10 years out of my art career to do that, because, life is short, and you only get a chance to do something like that once. And boy, if you don't enjoy it, you probably will feel like you missed something for the rest of your life.
You can't see Lauren's face right now, but I'm going to tell you guys that this is like the most satisfying experience that somebody, I can't relate, but Lauren, like, this is like creates like the most meaningful thing in his life, easily, if you could see his face. Well, it's really, really, likes his family a lot. So anyway, they are on their own now.
Pretty much.
you had. So anyway, so okay, there they are. Okay, we got past the kids. So you and
coming into the late 90s.
Yes. So what happened? How did you?
The kids are growing up and taking off on their own a little bit. Okay, so I'm still working and trying to get things going, but at this point, as I said, I kind of dropped out of the art world, and my wife, Kate, looked at me at some point in the late 90s and said, you know, you don't exist in New York. And I said, yeah, you know, you're right. And she said, you better figure out some way to exist or you're just going to disappear. And at that point, because our whole, you know, most of our community that we'd kind of grown up with in the East Village and some of the people in Soho, they had disappeared. They just vanished. So she said, you better work on this or it's, you know, it's over. So
is that from a partly a financial? Was that
yes,
a money thing or?
Well, partially, but also because she, you know, she was an artist. She knew that, you know, if you didn't have a career that you would be forgotten and that there were certain things that you had to do, you had then certain people that you had to be in touch with and certain magazines, you know, there's a whole network of the consecrators that you have to be involved with.
She probably thought that you really needed to paint is probably a lot of it too.
Well, that was, as I said, in a lot of ways, and this is maybe even more relevant today, the work is not the most important thing. The most important thing is your relationships. Everybody's doing interesting work. Everybody's, you know, trained. Everybody, and if you're not trained, you can certainly hire well-trained people to make the art for you. And, you know, we're talking about the phonies or not the phonies. So there's a lot of stuff that is being passed off that, you know, it ain't that good.
But if
you have a relationship with people, so if you have friends and people that are dealers, critics, curators, publishers, collectors, educators, if you have that network of relationships, that will make up for the bad product in a lot of ways, a lot of times.
Absolutely. But, you know, I'm talking about personal satisfaction. I think there's a lot of painters that would argue and say, I don't care about the relationships. I want to be in my studio.
Yeah,
I'd be happy just doing that.
I've heard that hundreds of times, and I always look at them and say, yeah, that's absolutely true. And I know 10 other people, and when they passed away, people backed up the dumpster. They took their career. They took this person's oeuvre, their life's work, threw it in the dumpster, and that was it.
So
I've seen that happen. I've seen that happen on many occasions.
I'm sure.
So if you're not out there making those connections and establishing some kind of a career and kind of staking your claim in the field of cultural production, if you haven't staked it, it's going to disappear.
Okay, so I'm going to challenge you by saying that I think that there are some people that don't think, I think that you care about that because you do, which is part of what we're trying to figure out. And also, you've seen it happen and you have a sense of history, I think. It's deeply ingrained in you. And that, I think, is partly why you don't want to have your work thrown away. No one really wants their work thrown away, but some people don't think about it. There's a lot of people who, we know this. So I'm saying, like, there are people out there. This is about you, Lauren. It's about you.
Okay.
So I'm saying it's interesting. That's all. It's interesting that you are part of art history, but you also have an interest in being part of art history.
Well, I think this is one of the ways that you kind of stake your claim. There are several different, like I was talking about, lenses or categories in which you can kind of establish a position in culture. One of them is historically, one of them is in the market, one of them is culturally. You can be somebody that's influential maybe because
right.
you write books or
right.
various kinds
right.
of things. A lot of my ideas that I've been looking at lately have come out of a French sociologist named Pierre Bourdieu, who I think is a genius.
See, just watch the videos. You don't have to read those books. Lauren is reading those books
for you. You should read the books because he's the guy that came up with the ideas of cultural capital.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he came up with the idea
of
cultural capital, and he also came up with the idea of the field of cultural production.
Okay, Lauren, we have 15 minutes, and I want to find out more.
All
so
right,
anyway, it. No. So what about, okay, so Now, you started doing James Calm in 2006. Yes. So
No. I was saying, it's in the late 90s. My wife is looking at me and she's saying, you've got to do something to get back into the art world. You don't exist. You're invisible. Mm-hmm. You've become invisible. You faded away. What are you going to do? So at that point, I was looking around and thinking, oh my God, you know, why was it that I never really was received, critically received, or institutionally received?
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of that was because I never really had the relationships with the critics and the curators. And because I, you know, I think a lot of the connections that people live on, especially here in New York, come out of things because they went to schools at places like Yale, Columbia, Harvard, Princeton. If you were part of that, you have a network. Basically, that's why people are paying a couple hundred thousand dollars. You get to buy a little network of people that then you grow up with. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Where's your alma mater?
Syracuse?
Okay, that's
But I was an art director. I never set out to do this.
Anyway, so I had none of that. So I had to think to myself, how am I going to try to crack that field? And I came up with the idea that, and I had a friend that had started writing for a little magazine called New York Arts. And so then I approached the editor of New York Arts and I said, gee, could I start doing some writing? And he said, okay, look, we want you to write little 2 or 3 line blurbs for our listing. So they would have 200 mm-hmm. galleries listed mm-hmm. and then maybe 20 of those would have a little blurb of, you know, this is someone doing photographs of Israel or something. And so you, mm-hmm. but you'd have to go to say 10 or 15 shows, make little notes and then go and write mm-hmm. them. So I did that for about 6 months. Then the guy said, why don't you do something that's 300 words? So I did 300 words.
Did you enjoy writing?
I did enjoy writing.
Did you find that a talent? I mean, you are talented.
I'm a bad writer. I had to work. I'm still working at it. I'm a bad writer. Mm-hmm. I'm more of a visual person, but it forced me to also spend a lot of time studying art criticism and other people. So, of course, I had to go back and start reading Clement Greenberg, Harold mm-hmm. Rosenberg,
mm-hmm.
all the Bergs. Mm-hmm. And then I started studying more classical philosophy of aesthetics and things like that. But it was important. And also, I think it's good to try to write because it makes you clarify your ideas about art.
Yeah.
And anyway, at some point, the guy just said to me, look, write something that's 800 words. And that's like a real review. So I did that. And at that point, he just said, write as much as you want. And within a period of about 2 months, I ended up writing as much as 10,000 words a month, which is a lot.
Yeah.
And, I mean, when they're actually publishing 10,000 words, you're probably writing 50,000 words and you have to throw out about 40,000 of them to get down to the 10 or 5,000 words that you publish. Anyway, so I was doing that, but I decided that I didn't want to be writing as Lauren Monk because the New York art scene is very biased and very, what can I say, elitist. And if they think that you're a painter that didn't make it, that's why you're writing. So I came up with James Calm. James is my middle name. K-A is for my wife's name and L-M is Lauren Monk. So I put that together and came up with the K-A-L-M. So that's my name, my nom de guerre. And I wrote under that as a pseudonym for 10 years. Nobody knew that I was writing about that. And so from about 1997, 98 until 2006 or 7, I was writing under a pseudonym.
And you were writing for the Brooklyn Rail as well?
I was writing for the Brooklyn Rail.
Which is like, if you don't know, that's a major, important art publication.
I started writing for the Brooklyn Rail, I believe, in 2000 or 2001.
So that's like top of the line, folks. That's
well, it wasn't top of the line then. It was just getting off the ground. And that was another beautiful experience was having a chance to kind of be part of the Brooklyn Rail family from the beginning. You know, and let me put out my props to Fong Bui. I love this guy and the whole family there. And it was great to see this kind of start out from a very ragtag group of kids until it's come up to where now it's probably one of the most prestigious art publications in New York City and maybe in the world.
It's very serious. I mean, it's like,
gotten more serious. It didn't used to be that serious. It's gotten a little too serious these days.
But there's nothing like it. That's what I'm saying. Like, it's legitimate
true.
Work.
That's
it's legitimate
true.
Writing, legitimate art, legitimate, you know, legitimate everything. It's legitimate.
Yeah, I was very lucky because at some point they brought in John Yao and another guy, Thomas Michelli, and they tapped me because of my expertise. They tapped me to write an article every month called The Brooklyn Dispatches. And so I'd been concentrating mostly on Brooklyn before that, and I decided when I started writing art criticism that I did want to kind of look at more of the marginal places. And that's about the same time that Williamsburg started to take off. So I basically concentrated all my efforts on Brooklyn. And at that point, I guess this was 2004, 2005, I just was writing the Brooklyn Dispatches, which was great. And one of the things that I'm kind of sad about the Brooklyn Rail is that they very rarely cover Brooklyn stuff anymore, you know?
Yeah, so common. So, I mean, they're not alone in that. So what about those relationships that you were trying to, you know?
Well, it was good because one of the things is that as an art critic, the gallerist will take you in as a different type of person.
Sure.
And they will bring you into the back and they will share confidences with you that they would never. First of all, if you're an artist and you walk in with your little portfolio or your book of slides or whatever, they just like look at you and go, you know, go next door, well, go somewhere, anywhere but here. But where it's like, oh, no, I can write a review. I'll write it like 800-word review, yeah, that will appear in something that's got 10,000 viewers or 10,000 subscribers. Suddenly it's like, oh, come on in the back room. Oh, you want a drink? Yeah, sit down. Well, this is what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. This is da-da-da. Mm-hmm. You should do it.
We have like 8 minutes, and I want to get to the video part.
Yes.
Sorry.
Okay, we'll talk very fast.
Okay, so how did you wind up getting to the video part?
This is why I'm so lucky and privileged to have intelligent and inquisitive children. So I'm writing for the Brooklyn Rail, and one of the things I did was I would run around and I would take pictures, and at some point I upgraded to a Canon ELF camera. One day I'm coming home and I was downloading my photos, and I looked at this new icon on there, I popped on it, and a little video popped up, and it was like, you know, the camera dangling as I'm pedaling across the Brooklyn Bridge, and I looked at it and said, that's funny, gee, what, I could do something with that. Week or two goes by, Irving Sandler had written an article that appeared in the Brooklyn Rail talking about how art criticism had fallen apart and that the dealers and the market was basically taking over. And so I put those two things, and he was saying there's got to be new voices, there's got to be new ways of reaching out. I put those two things together. My kids came up to me and said, oh, hey, there's this thing called YouTube on the internet, you know? And so I'm looking at, I got a little camera that'll take video. Irving Sandler was calling for new voices, and there's this thing called YouTube, and I was thinking about it, and I said, gee, I could somehow put this together and make some kind of art thing about it. So I started doing little reports, basically taught myself how to, and it was my kids basically taught me how to do it, started me on this. And so that was 2006. I started doing videos, and I basically had to learn how to do all this. I had a very, very primitive editing program. The camera was very bad. And they're all still online. You can go look at them and see how bad they are. But that started out. And then, as I said, I just had to keep working and developing the technique and getting better cameras and things like that.
But you enjoyed it. How did you feel doing it? Like, what was different? Or, like, what are you drawn to?
Okay, so I was actually lucky, as you were saying, that I started writing the art criticism, and that made me start to think about art in a different way. But also, it made me articulate my ideas about specific kinds of things. It could be the social commentary that somebody might be doing, or it could be technical things. So I just felt that taking someone in, you know, it's one thing to look at a photograph and read text. That's one way, and that's the classic way that I've always looked at art criticism. But I was thinking, this could be something that could be fun. You're actually out walking around, you're talking about things. And sometimes I see people in the gallery and we'll talk about things. But you can see things, you can move in, you can do close-ups, you can move back, you can see who's there, you can sort of feel like you're in a relationship with the cultural world of New York. Hmm. And I always thought that would be an important way of getting people to experience art.
So you really like the process. It's very immediate, isn't it?
I do like the process. It's very immediate. As a matter of fact, before I came over here today, I was editing a video on a Richard Prince show that opened maybe last
I saw that.
Friday. I'm going to be probably posting that when I get home. Tomorrow or the next day, I'll be doing Andy Warhol. I was at the Andy Warhol show yesterday morning. So And if I didn't have other things backed up, I would probably be able to turn this stuff around in like 2 or 3 hours, which is very immediate.
Well, that's what I want to ask you. How do you do both of those things? So you're a prolific painter and a prolific, or what is this, like a workaholic thing, or like, how do you do it all?
Well, you just do it.
You just, you have it.
I decided that the video things are as important as the painting things.
Okay.
I enjoy it. I also feel a certain amount of responsibility to my viewers. I've got something like 25,000 subscribers on between the two channels, and I get letters from people. And well, just my last video, I've got people from South Africa, Oregon, rural England, and things sending me little notes. And I feel like, you know, this is one way that I can sort of get the art out to them, because they're hungry. They want to know what's going on in New York, and a lot of people wouldn't pay attention to them. And I feel like they need their little fix.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot of teachers that use your videos.
Yes, I've gotten a lot of notes from a lot of teachers all over the world.
Yeah, so it's a really great contribution. I mean, in real time, you know, it's not like, you know, it's not like you have to wait for having a show or something. So your artwork, your visual, your painting, and your videos inform each other, I'm guessing.
Yes, they do. They do.
So did Kate ever wind up going back to art, or?
Well, occasionally. She kind of, at some point, she said somebody's got to be the grown-up in this relationship, and she got a very good job. She actually was working at Columbia for the dean there for a while, and then she's working now at a wonderful foundation, and, you know, we enjoy the health care and all these other things.
Oh,
so,
that's
but,
great.
You know, it's like she tries to get out, but we keep pulling her back.
Yeah, I know. How come? Yeah, she's because you're on the scene as well. I mean, you know, as whatever, but not at everything. But you're around. You're a presence. And does she not like to ride bikes, or where is she? Where is that woman? I want to get to know her. She sounds amazing.
She's a gym rat. So, and she's got a lot she's got a lot of responsibilities at her job. So that keeps her tied up there quite a bit.
But she's in great shape.
She is in great shape, and she's out there working out and doing all kinds of things at the gym. And she's got a very robust group of people that she works with, the community there. And so she spends a lot of time on doing that. And we try to spend time together on the weekends.
And she doesn't really need to go there, because she's got you with doing all that for her.
Occasionally,
firsthand.
We're going to go see the Warhol show together and do some other things. She still enjoys art, and she makes a little, you know, things here and there. And she, you know,
it's
she has
nice
to watch
that,
it.
It's nice that you guys share that, though, right? You share art.
I'm a very, very lucky man.
That's a big deal.
She's made a lot of incredible sacrifices still making sacrifices on a daily basis.
Well, you know, I mean, she's got a great husband who really appreciates her. We don't hear that enough. That's what women complain about. They don't feel appreciated. So I'm sure she does. And I also want you folks to know that I've known Lauren, you know, since the 90s, I think. I probably could have known him since Utrecht days, but he has always spoken so lovingly of his wife, and it's something that I have noted about him, that he really appreciates his wife. And I want you guys to know that, because, you know, Phil, get with it. Get with the program. No, Phil's really good, too. Phil's good.
Good, Phil.
But one more question, and we're going
to
stick around. Stick around. So stay tuned. We've got a great afternoon of programming. Ben, it's Ben Talks, and it's Lost and Rewound. So much great stuff to come. If somebody, a collector from the 80s, would they recognize your work today, vice versa?
They could. They could. Once you kind of have a certain kind of feel for color and shape and form and things like that, I think it stays with you.
Yeah.
I think it stays with you.
Cool. All right. But the old stuff's abstract.